Our first reading is excerpted from the speeches and writings of Vaclav Havel. The salvation of the human world lies nowhere else than in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human needs, and in human responsibility. We are still a long way from the family of humankind. In fact, we seem at times to be receding from the ideal rather than drawing closer to it. Interests of all kinds, personal, selfish, state, national, group, and if you like, corporate interests, still considerably outweigh genuinely global interests. We are still under the destructive and vain belief that humanity is the pinnacle of creation and not just part of it, and therefore everything is permitted. I am not an optimist because I am not sure that everything ends well, nor am I a pessimist because I am not sure that everything ends badly. I just carry hope in my heart. Hope is a feeling that life and work have meaning. You either have it or you don't, regardless of the state of the world around you. The more unpropitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper that hope is. The most important form of hope, the only one that can keep us above water and urge us to good works, and the only true source of the breathtaking dimension of the human spirit and its efforts, is something we get, as it were, from elsewhere. It is also this hope, above all, which gives us the strength to live and to continually to try new things, to reconnect in responsibility to something higher than my family, my country, my firm, my success. Responsibility to the order of being, where all our actions are indelibly recorded and where, and only where, they will be properly judged.
In these words from T.S. Eliot, from East Coker, in the Four Quartets, I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness, the dancing.
It's wonderful to be back here this morning. I think the last time I was here was just about the time this worship space was being dedicated, and I was a candidate for the presidency of our association. And when one of the things that my family and friends had to put up with was hearing me introduced everywhere as the evangelical rabbi of liberal religion, a title that was bestowed on me along with the stole and an honorary doctorate by the seminary that Eric went to, which provoked my daughter to send me a card that she found at college that year that had on it the drawing of a guy about my age and girth with glasses in a well-traveled robe and a prayer shawl, and wearing where the hair was all somehow loved off on top, a little yarmulke labeled the Velveteen Rabbi. With the caption, "So when do I get to go out and run and play with the real rabbis?" So when people like Kathleen and Eric and Mark invite me to come preach and come play, as I will with your district summer institute this week at Kenyon College, who am I to say no? Religion is people. It may express itself as ideas. It may take form in groups and institutions. Leaders may develop, but before everything else, religion is people. Those are the first sentences in my newest book, Universalists and Unitarians in America, A People's History. It's called that because most previous histories treated Unitarianism and Universalism separately, although the two joined forces 50 years ago this summer. And most also focused either on ideas, since we were named for them, or on institutions. Since being relatively small, we have been self-conscious about ours. While without neglecting either, mine focuses just on people, both the remembered and the forgotten, the known and the unknown. Because while our faith has produced more than its share of American notables, just listing luminaries is a little bit like looking up at the night sky and seeing there only the brightest stars, when in order to see the most interesting patterns, you must also discern the lights of second and third order magnitude. So let me give you just a couple of examples from our past, which somehow helped me understand the process of hope. In the fateful year 1929, as the Great Depression was beginning, Time magazine chose as its man of the year a universalist, a layman named Owen D. Young. You probably don't even know his name today, but Will Rogers, the humorist who also famously said, "I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat." Rogers said he wanted Owen D. Young to be the Democratic candidate for president in 1932 as the most likely to get us out of the Depression. Back then, Owen Young was known as perhaps the most progressive and effective business leader and peacemaker and advocate for ordinary working people that America had. He'd grown up on a farm in the Mohawk Valley of upstate New York, near the village of Van Hornersville, a real crossroads. The little Universalist church in which he was raised made him superintendent of the Sunday school when he was all of 15. That summer, a seminary student came to preach and was impressed with young Owen and wrote to the president at St. Lawrence University, the Universalist College and Seminary, that it was a pity that Owen would never get to go to college. Being an only child, needed on the family farm. and the president came down to Van Hornersville in person to meet Owen and give him a scholarship and persuade his parents to let him go. He excelled at school. He married a fellow Universalist. He became an attorney that specialized in public utilities, just as America was becoming electrified. And by the 1920s, he was chairman of the board of General Electric and the founder of RCA and the founder and first chairman of NBC. Time magazine, though, honored him as a peacemaker because he had gone twice to Europe to ask the victors in the Great World War to ease up on their reparation demands from Germany, seeing that those were likely to lead to a second war and were already provoking the rise of Hitler and Nazism. At GE, Owen Young provided not just pensions and disability and health insurance for all workers that later influenced the New Deal. He advocated not just for a living wage, but what he called a cultural wage that would be large enough for ordinary working people to improve their lives and that of their families through education and culture. He made generous pledges to cultural and religious institutions, including his hometown church, and funding the Universalist National Memorial Church in Washington, D.C., where the bell tower is named the Owen D. Young Peace Tower, and to his college, St. Lawrence, where the library is named for him, and to the first professional school for the study of foreign relations at Johns Hopkins, and then the bottom fell out of the economy. Soon, Owen Young owed more in charitable pledges than he was probably worth. Rather than run for president himself, he sat his family down and said that they would never lack for education or basic security, but they shouldn't expect riches. His plan was to keep as many people employed as he could and to support Roosevelt for president and to keep his charitable pledges. He paid every penny, though it took him decades. And toward the end of his long life in the 1950s, Owen D. Young, Universalist, could be seen some Sunday afternoons along Route 1 on Florida's East Coast, selling grapefruit from his orchard at a roadside stand in front of his modest retirement home. I call him an unsung hero and a person of hope and integrity. Universalism's faith in a loving God not only rejected belief in an eternal hell, its larger hope, as an Ohio Universalist Gordon McKeeman once put it, was really this worldly. Since we're all going to the same place anyhow, in the end, we better start trying to treat one another decently right here and now, huh? American Universalism often said that its founder was an English-born preacher, John Murray, but actually it rose quite indigenously among rural farmers like Owen Young's family, though further east in the hill country of inland New England, and during the American Revolution, and without much benefit of clergy. Which brings me to a story from the Unitarian side of our family and that era. Bet you don't know the name Hannah Adams either. Yet this author and Unitarian, a distant cousin of John Adams, to be sure, was America's first scholar of comparative religion. Her father had gotten to go to Harvard, but was far too bookish and shy to ever be a preacher, or a lawyer, or even a successful merchant, though he did try selling books to his neighboring farmers out in rural Medfield, Massachusetts. And he tutored their boys in Latin and Greek so they could go to college. And Hannah benefited from the same education and helped in the school. With the Revolution, Harvard closed, the college buildings being used for Washington's army, and some of the students were boarded out at the Adams House in Medfield. One of them brought Hannah a book about the various denominations and faiths. She'd heard of Universalists. They were nearby, and Quakers and Baptists and Anglicans and Catholics and Jews. She knew not everybody belonged to a congregational church like the one she grew up in Medfield. But in this book, all the forms of faith that didn't agree with the author were called heresy. And Hannah wondered if it wouldn't be better to just let people describe their own path and faith from their own point of view. So she did research and interviews. She even wrote to the first Catholic bishop in the United States, John Carroll, down in Maryland, to see if her Protestant background had led her to mischaracterize Catholicism. First published in 1784, with three later enlarged editions, her Dictionary of Religions, it was finally called, was the first attempt in English to deal with other faiths and denominations fairly and objectively. One of her sources was William Bentley, an early Unitarian, even before the Revolution and before there was any organized denomination of that name, minister of the Old East Church in Salem, near the docks, where ships left regularly for the India and China trade. Bentley would tell the ship captains, "You're going to France, eh? Bring me that new French-Persian dictionary. I want to teach myself Persian." He learned 19 languages, became the only man in America who could translate Arabic, and did it for Thomas Jefferson when he was Secretary of State, so effectively that Jefferson offered him the presidency of the University of Virginia. Through him, Hannah Adams was able to paint the differences between Sunni and Shiite and Sufi Muslims in a way that most Americans today still haven't mastered. Hannah never married, but may also have become the first American of either gender to successfully earn a living through writing books. That alone makes her one of my patron saints. She wrote on geography and New England history and topics of interest to both women and men in an era when college wasn't even open to women. And nothing similar was being taught to college men. A rival author of hers was the Reverend Jedediah Morse, the arch-Calvinist minister of the First Parish Church in Charleston, Massachusetts, just across from Boston, the church that John Harvard himself had served. Morse actually took some of Hannah's writings and published them as his own, while condemning Unitarians for stealing New England religion. Some of Hannah's Unitarian friends sued on her behalf. Morse was found guilty, then refused to pay the judgment. When his own Calvinist congregation found out about this unchristian conduct toward poor Hannah, they fired him. And the ultimate irony is that Morse's own son, Samuel, by first vocation a painter, then the inventor of the telegraph and of Morse code, joined a Unitarian church down in Baltimore, where Channing, the Unitarian leader back in Boston, preached the sermon that finally claimed the Unitarian name. I could go on. I love these stories of people from our own family of faith who prove the role that progressive religion has forever had in renewing hope at every critical juncture, especially in our nation's history. UU historian Sidney Mead once called America the nation with the soul of a church, pointing out that if you want to change America, you had better try to touch its soul. There's no other route. Certainly not just through power politics. And so we progressives neglect our own history and theology to our detriment. If we don't know it, our history, that is, we are often condemned to repeat it. And if we skate just on its surface, not into its spiritual depth, we miscalculate and misplace our hopes and don't know hope's transcendent quality. Have you ever placed hope in the wrong thing? I sure have, repeatedly. Perhaps like many growing up in this country, disillusioned with conventional religion, you once hoped that religion itself would just disappear. Seeing diversity in religion as just a source of human division, rather than also as a multiform source of deeper human wisdom and compassion and connection. Forgetting that just as nature abhors a vacuum, so does the human soul. And to be human is to hope, and to trust, and to love, and to connect repeatedly, often unwisely, God knows. And as the prophets testify in the Hebrew Bible, Zechariah speaks of people who become prisoners of their hope. And Buddhists teach that as we humans practice it, hope can be an almost addictive attachment to one ephemeral thing after another. And no wonder, Eliot writes. Oh, by the way, his grandfather founded the Unitarian Church in St. Louis, you know. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. For hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the hope and the love are all in the waiting. And surely Václav Havel is also right when he says that authentic human hope is a quality of the heart, a transcendent quality coming, as it were, from beyond present circumstance. And far from attaching itself always to results, forever pointing beyond that place on the horizon beyond which none of us can see, but beyond a point toward which we know, we sense in our hearts, we have to keep moving. If human life itself is to be meaningful for ourselves and for those who will follow us. This, it seems to me, is the characteristic stance of true progressives in all religion. Those whose faith is not grounded in fear. Those who do not promote religion as a form of nostalgia for faded formulae and unjust hierarchy. Rebecca Parker and I made that case in my last book, A House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion in the 21st Century. That nothing is more important in our time than hopeful, inclusive faith, promoting compassion and connection. But you know that, or you would not be here this morning. The task of the preacher, you know, is not to inform, but to remind. Just last month, a young Muslim woman giving the baccalaureate speech at the University of California made the very same point, ending by quoting Wordsworth's lines written above Tintern Abbey, where he pronounced himself filled not only with a sense of present pleasure, but with pleasing thought that in this moment there is life and food for future years. And so I dare to hope, he wrote. Hope, said Sara Salawi, by its very nature, is an act of defiance, as in the defiance of the Arab Spring. It is never easy or simple, nor born out of mere naivete or ignorance. It is born out of states of doubt and even despair. And therefore, as Václav Havel says, never the same as optimism or the assurance that all will be well. Hope is not prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit in the face of not knowing. It is a life of integrity and courage. It is one that never ceases asking where to place my hope, where to give life meaning. It doesn't wait for life to show its meaning. It gives life toward that which provides meaning. No culture, no community, no nation, nor species as a whole has much chance without such courageous risks of the spirit. And so, like our forebears before us, like Hannah, trying to treat all others fairly, like Owen, knowing someone had invested in his future, and he would invest in the future of others. Let us too resolve this morning to lead lives of ever transcendent hope, and not in words alone, nor in seeking remembrance or reward, but in the very passion and orientation of our hearts and our spirits. So may it be. Amen.